Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday morning, the 6th of November. Our guest this hour is Eugene Jarecki. He is the author of The American Way of War, Guided Missiles, Misguided Men, and A Republic in Peril. He's an award-winning filmmaker whose work includes Why We Fight, which won the 2005 Sundance Film Festival's Grand Jury Prize and a 2006 Peabody Award, as well as the film The Trials of Henry Kissinger. He is the founder and director of the Eisenhower Project, an academic public policy group dedicated to studying U.S. foreign policy. The film Why We Fight sought to make sense of Americans', he says, seemingly inexorable path to the tragic quagmire in Iraq. He was distressed to see a national tragedy converted by the White House into the pretext for a preemptive war. And a lot of this book is about the war in Iraq, but it goes beyond that. It is really looking at those words uttered so long ago by President Dwight Eisenhower, the military-industrial complex, and that we should be aware of that. So he looks at the Bush Doctrine, the NSA scandal, the failure of Congress to perform its checking function, he believes, which must be examined and understood as a culmination of a long story in which runaway militarism and executive power have propelled America away from her founding Republican principles into the storm of military, economic, and societal changes that we face now. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Eugene. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you would like to send us an email, feel free to do that. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Eugene, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Tell me about your response to 9/11. I know you had friends who lost their lives there. Everybody was so struck by that moment. But when we look at how that translated into where we are now, it's a story that has a long history, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I mean, I'm a New Yorker, and so I took the events of 9/11 very much on the chin, as so many of us did who knew people in the towers. I had a special, strange distinction, which is that I had worked in the World Trade Center in the 1990s many years ago, and I had gone on to do different things and left friends who were still working in the building when the tragedy happened. And strangely, many months later, after 9/11, I was visited by the police department of the city of New York, and they brought me something of my own, a possession of my own that they had found in the rubble.
Oh, my God.
And out of an envelope, they took out this sort of burned and mangled and charred identification card. It was a building access card that I used to use to get in the morning. And I remembered immediately that a decade or so ago, I had dropped it behind the file cabinet and couldn't move the file cabinet and get it out. Well, they found it, and they brought it to me, and there I stood holding this image of myself. You know, if ever there was a moment where you could say, there but for the grace of God go I,
right,
that was it. But it drew special attention for me on thinking about the very personal component of loss on that day, because at the same time, as a very political thinker, I was otherwise very focused on what, you know, quite heavily focuses on, which is the long American story that led us to 9/11, to that kind of tragedy, that kind of involvement in what the framers called foreign entanglements,
mm-hmm.
that we were suddenly finding ourselves with Americans saying, what is this? How did we end up such a kind of involvement in the world that we're looked at this way, that we're seen as worthy of this kind of attack?
Right. Did you save that? Did you save the...
Do I have it? You mean the ID card? Yeah,
it's
a very prized possession of mine.
Yeah, I would imagine. So here we are. There's a lot of joy all over the world, as you know, from what happened with the American election. They're dancing in the streets in some parts of the world. And
yes,
yet you say that this new president is still going to face that pull to reward congressional districts that are part of the military-industrial complex, that it is very, very, very hard to make substantive changes when it comes to how the United States performs militarily all over the world.
That is extremely true, and with all the best appreciation for all of this, I mean, I share in the joy, the triumph of Barack Obama, the triumph of a campaign of real decency as he ran. I mean, Barack ran a campaign of decency and depth, and where he was willing to deal with complex issues and not give flashy answers and also not stoop to viciousness or bitterness. And that triumphed over a campaign that we all can say is really quite the reverse. So that is a wonderful moment in its own right, and it's a wonderful moment in the history of the struggle of African Americans for any kind of equity in this society. All of that is deeply meaningful to me. At the same time, that doesn't change or even make it difficult to also understand that America has a very systematized form of corruption at work, and that no single individual, no matter how well-intended or even how smart, as Barack Obama clearly is, can possibly do this alone. And frankly, it's Barack Obama more than anyone else who is telling us that he needs us, he needs the public to help him. He literally said in his acceptance speech, "I need your help." Those could not be clearer words, and what he means is not something vague. He means that the public is the only force that can compel Washington to behave in a way that is less poisoned by the corrosive corruptions that we see up till now. Mm-hmm. And I can talk more specifically about those. My book, of course, goes through how Washington really works and shows you why it can make this kind of change.
Well, let me ask you, it's not an easy question here and fairly large question. What is that systematized form of corruption, Eugene?
Well, Eisenhower called it the military-industrial complex because he was trying to put a very clear face on it. I have to mention, and this will help people start to understand the bigger picture of this, that Eisenhower's original phrase, military-industrial complex, that phrase was, in the original draft, different. He actually had started out with the phrase military-industrial congressional complex. And in the later draft of the speech, he took out the word congressional. But let's put it back for a moment, because he took it out for political reasons at the time. I think it should be back because I think it's what he meant. And what he means by military-industrial congressional complex is exactly what it sounds like, which is you have a concentration of power in corporate power in Washington, which combines with congressional power, so that you have like a triangle, the military on one side, industry on another, and then the third side of the triangle is Congress. And how does that happen? Well, every congressperson needs two things more than anything else in the world. They need money and they need jobs. Jobs in the district so that they literally are the people who bring people their livelihoods in their district. That makes people like them and vote for them. And then at campaign time, they need money. And they need that money so that they can place ads to say, hey, by the way, public, I'm the guy who brought the jobs. So because the congressperson needs those two things, they need to keep their corporate benefactors in their district, and they need to keep them happy. And the way you do that, if you're a congressperson, is you effectively become a professional pleader. A guy in the Pentagon used that term to explain it to me. You become a professional pleader on behalf of your corporate interest to whom? Well, to the executive branch. Why? Because historically, ever since World War II, the executive branch has become the go-to branch that guides national priorities and budget spending. Because inside the executive branch is every agency that controls those things that corporate America wants. So, for example, let's say in your district you have an arms maker where you're going to be lobbying to the executive branch because the Department of Defense is inside the executive branch. If it's a pharmaceutical giant, well, you're going to be talking to the Food and Drug Administration. Sure. Lo and behold, that's in the executive branch. A polluter, that's the EPA. That's in the executive branch. You're talking about a media company, that's the FCC. That's in the executive branch. Wall Street, the SEC. It goes on and on. Mm-hmm. And what happened ever since World War II is a shift in what the framers intended in terms of a balance of power between the branches. Today, the executive branch has 6 million employees, about 5.5 million employees. The Congress has 30,000. The judicial branch has 30,000. The ever rumors that you would end up with an executive branch at that level of size, personnel, and wealth, and for power, they...
Hello? Hello? Been having problems with his phone lately, so we will try and reach our guest again. And we'll be welcoming phone calls early on here as well. Our guest this hour is Eugene Jarecki. He's the author of The American Way of War, Guided Missiles, Misguided Men, and a Republic in Peril. And the book looks at America's militarism. He is remembering former President Dwight Eisenhower's comments about the military-industrial. That's interesting that he says Eisenhower had the phrase congressional complex, but he, for political reasons, made it the military-industrial complex. And We're talking about his book, and it had a very interesting part where he talks with Senator John McCain, who's actually a part of the film, for those of you who have seen the film, and what happened as a result of McCain's comments in that film and his staff being extremely concerned about what he had to say concerning war. So we'll hear that story in just a moment as well. And welcome phone calls for our guest, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is our number. And we will very shortly be going to your phone calls for our guest. And also taking your emails, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Eugene, are you you're there again?
I'm back. Sorry
okay.
about that.
That's all right.
We're having thundery weather in New York City, so it's getting a little bit of trouble with the line.
Right. Okay. Well, there you are again. But you were in the middle of a sentence, and I had to just keep talking, so I can't remember the middle of your sentence.
Okay.
Right
well,
now.
Basically, the congressperson becomes a pleader on behalf of the corporate sector to the executive branch. Now, that wouldn't be so bad except for the fact that take the following scenario. Let's say you're a congressperson, and this is a totally fictional scenario, but it's just helpful to make people understand this. On a Monday, as a congressperson, you have to make a phone call because somebody in your district, the corporation, makes the F-22 fighter. Mm-hmm. Now, the F-22 is an aircraft we've spent $70 billion on. It's an air-to-air combat aircraft, and we don't have an enemy with an Air Force. So this fighter has come under a lot of fire in Washington, not surprisingly, because it's a kind of insane, ridiculous waste of American taxpayer dollars. So in order to keep the F-22's company happy, you're going to try to lobby the DOD, the Department of Defense, why the F-22 should stay in our arsenal, why it's important, why we should keep blowing money on it. So on a Monday, you call the executive branch, within it, the Department of Defense, and you tell the Department of Defense, hey, I don't need to tell you that the people in my district who make the F-22, we care a lot about it, we work hard on it, we believe it's a valuable part of America's defense, no matter what people say, and we hope you'll consider that when the review comes up for it later this year. Well, the DOD says, thank you very much for your call. Of course, we're looking at lots of systems, but we too value the F-22, and thank you very much, Congressman, for your call. That's on a Monday. On a Tuesday, the executive branch calls you, the congressman. Your phone rings, and it's another member of the branch, and that member is the president. And he says to you, hey, congressman, I think there might be WMDs in Iraq, mm-hmm. and I'm hoping I can count on your support if I feel the need to take
mm-hmm.
action. Well, just yesterday, you were the guy asking for a favor.
Right.
So are you going to do your Jeffersonian duty and say, Mr. President, you show me the evidence of those WMDs?
Mm-hmm.
Well, or are you going to do what so many, for example, Democrats did, who left their constituency scratching their head, where you're just going to fall awfully silent, mm-hmm. the way anyone who's in a conflict of interest would. And you're going to hope that no one notices while you softly acquiesce to the executive's wishes so that your corporate benefactor continues to get the largesse from the executive branch that they're seeking. And I could have used this example of the F-22 with a drug company. It doesn't have to be a gun maker. The point is not that it's the gun makers that lead us to war. The point is that a corporate political complex in Washington erodes our society from within and also has the tendency to lead toward executive power. And the framers teach us that executives want war. Or, as Madison said, favors the executive.
What about if you're living in a time when we are now, Eugene? Do programs like this bite the dust simply because we don't have the money anymore?
Well, that's another thing that Eisenhower was afraid of. And the reason I feel so strongly about Eisenhower is here's a man who was both a fiscal and military conservative. He understood that you cannot be a fiscal conservative and also be supportive of massive, expansive adventurism around the world. And so those do go hand in glove. You know, his whole point was you can bet it's a wonderful idea. He teaches us you cannot have perfect security. That comes from Eisenhower. And he said, not only can't you have it, but everybody always tries to pursue it as nations, and you can destroy a nation from within by trying to protect it from without. That's his own phrase. And that idea is very important to us today because we all know that we leave our house in the morning and we could get hit by a car, anything could happen. And we don't plan accordingly. We don't not leave the house because it could be dangerous. We don't carry a gun on us at all times because somebody might be out there. We take risk. We say the world is imperfect. And yet at a national level, we're told we must stop at nothing to hyper-securitize ourselves against all these threats that are out there. We mm-hmm. act like a complete hysteric. And in doing that, of course, we rob money from all the aspects of what makes a nation strong. So it's like you have a great big house. It's full of nice expensive, fancy things. You decide everybody's out to get me. This is kind of a metaphor for America. Everybody's out to get me. They all want my stuff. So you start pawning your stuff piece by piece to build a bigger and bigger gun. Well, at the end of the day, you'll end up with a huge gun and an empty house.
Interesting. Let's pause for a moment and we'll return and take phone calls. We'll hear the John McCain story momentarily, I promise you. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is the author of The American Way of War, Guided Missiles, Misguided Men, and A Republican Peril. He's an award-winning filmmaker, and his film includes the 2005-06 Sundance Film Festival's Grand Jury Prize film, The American Way of War, which won so many prizes, and many of you have seen it already. And I've had a couple calls, Eugene, you'll be interested in this, from people saying this should be required viewing in high schools. I'm Kathleen Dunn, to you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We get a phone calls now for Eugene, and we'll start with Fred from Madison. Hi, Fred.
Good morning.
Hello.
How are you?
Pardon?
Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I'm generally pretty articulate, but when I get in an audience, I stumble on my words, so they'll excuse me. But I just wanted to provide what I believe is a real specific example of the military-industrial complex, primarily the industrial complex, and one of the huge problems we have in this country and how simple it would be to solve it if we only had the gall to move against some of these enormous resources. Health insurance and health coverage and health care is tremendously expensive in this country. And it's only for one reason, is that the private insurance companies are making enormous profits and taking so much of the health care dollar that we really need to have someone with courage to begin to regulate that concept, whether we move towards a single-payer system or not. That's somebody who can work on the details. But we need to regulate these insurance companies because that's where all of the enormous expense of health care is captured.
Okay. Your phone is a little bit shaky there, but we did hear you, Fred. Did you hear that, Eugene? I know we had problems with your phone, too.
I just heard the tail end of it, and I think the question is how we're going to look at the sort of the reform of health care under Obama.
Right, right. And private insurance companies taking in so much profit, et cetera.
Well, it's a component of the argument I'm making more broadly about how our members of Congress are beholden to these corporate interests. And that's not just a cliche. What I talk about in my book, The American Way of War, is the really specific dynamics by which they're held captive by them. That's, by the way, held captive is a phrase that Eisenhower used to describe this. He talked about the public interest being held captive by private interests. And that's what happens here. And Obama, with the best of intentions, can get in. But if the public is not tightening the screws on our members of Congress, on making our members of Congress qualify for our vote by starting to have appropriate processes in interacting with the corporate sector, then Obama is up against the entire weight of that branch and its corruption.
And thanks for the call. Tell us the story, please. I promised you would do this soon, of John McCain's appearance in your film, The American Way of War, and what happened as a result of his appearance.
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm not a man to kick a man when he's down.
Right.
And I certainly don't want to make John McCain's woes this week any worse by, you know, dredging up a story from our past together. But there's no question that during the election season, I was unable to look at John McCain maybe the same way the public does, because I think the public, you know, wanted to see in John McCain a kind of, you know, that whole maverick thing. They
sure
wanted to see a real guy who was outside the corruption of Washington. And having had very close interaction with the McCain camp, I had seen a very different side firsthand. John McCain appeared in my film, Why We Fight. He really wowed audiences both at Sundance and then across the country with some very outspoken words against aspects of the Iraq War, against corruption in the military-industrial complex. He quoted Eisenhower in the film. He even was outspoken about the doctrine of preemption in the film. He seemed to take issue with that, the Bush doctrine. And he ultimately took issue with the contracting practices of Halliburton. These were sort of all the things you would have wanted to see a guy like McCain talk about if you were looking for him to be a real lightning rod for change in Washington. So when we showed the film across the country, people loved it. The only people who didn't love it was McCain and his camp, who called us and started to hammer me personally on the telephone, really bully me as a young filmmaker, to change my film, to behave, to allow them access to all my raw material, the same thing they asked the LA Times to do recently. They wanted a very special kind of treatment, and I wanted my film to be independent of any political pressure. I was, frankly, totally heartbroken when they called, because I'd been really thrilled at the interaction with McCain up to that point. And I'd been really thrilled at how audiences were loving the John McCain who was willing to talk real straight talk about Washington. So now it was like, don't meet your idols. Like, this all started collapsing in front of me when I was getting the absolute full court press from Mark Salter, who is McCain's, both his chief of staff and a co-author of McCain's several books. You know, at a level of that was threats to smear my name, threats to call the BBC who had funded the film and never tell them never to work with me again. But it all came to a very specific head in one conversation with Mark Salter, in which Mr. Salter said to me, and he later repeated this to the newspaper, the Capitol Hill paper Roll Call, but he said to me, when John McCain sat down with you, he thought he was talking to a television program for the BBC.
Oh, my.
And I said, and I said, well, he was. We were funded by the BBC, and then later went on and by chance got into Sundance, and then that got picked. The movie got lucky, so because we won Sundance, and then it got picked up for theatrical. Well, he wasn't, you know, pleased at any of that. But I stopped and I said, but Mr. Salter, if you don't mind my asking you a question, I'm a little confused. Are you suggesting that there are things Senator McCain would be comfortable saying to a British audience that he's not comfortable saying to the American people? Well, that didn't help matters. So he got really angry, and then when we hung up, yes, he did go and try to smear my name. He referred to me as a, quote, slippery son of a gun, unquote, in a magazine, in Roll Call, where, you know, Marianne Akers, who wrote a story that said, attention, Barack Obama, you're not the only guy John McCain is gunning for. His staff is gunning for Eugene Jarecki, and they called me a slippery son of a gun, and they said I had done manipulative editing. I mean, to make John McCain say things that he didn't really say. I mean, if you watch the film, he talks in completely full sentences. You go on YouTube, the whole scene is on there under, I think, like McCain plus Why We Fight, and you'll see the scene, and it's kind of McCain talking. It's just they got very upset. They got particularly upset at one moment where he was in the middle of criticizing Halliburton, and while we were doing the interview, a phone rang off screen, and one of his staffers advised him that Vice President Cheney was on the phone. Mm. And he literally got up in the middle of the interview and left with the camera rolling to go take the call. And it's all very nervous and kind of anxious, and the audiences laugh because it's like, oh, my God, he's talking about Halliburton and Cheney called. And they didn't like that moment, but not because it made John McCain look too close to Dick Cheney. That wasn't what it turned out. It turned out they thought he didn't look close enough, that the fact that he was criticizing Halliburton in that context made them feel that the film was trying to suggest that John McCain was in some way a critic of Dick Cheney. And Mark Salter went out of his way to let me know that, and also told us to Roll Call, that Senator McCain has the highest regard for Mr. Cheney's integrity.
So who are you, John McCain?
But that's going to be the question going forward. I think for John McCain himself, I wrote a piece last week about John McCain, about this episode, and I think what we saw in the campaign was a division inside John McCain's own soul. I don't think anyone should chalk this up to Sarah Palin or to, you know, missteps in the campaign or anything like that. This is about John McCain being a divided human being. I mean, let's look at it bluntly. John McCain's most singular and most sensitive and noted issue of his life is the fact that he was a tortured POW. The fact that he was a tortured POW and that he then ran a campaign that from the start had to play politics with the torture issue, where he didn't want to go too far in critiquing the Bush administration's totally anti-democratic, totally un-American approach to torture, because he didn't want to distance himself from the Bush White House. So now he had to play politics on the most sensitive issue of his life. From that moment on, I say you're off to the races. It's a really hard road for John McCain to know who to be in that campaign.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call, Fred. Let's go to Jake from Menasha. Hi, Jake.
Hi, good morning. I just had a quick comment and then a question. First of all, I want to thank Wisconsin Public Radio for bringing this guest forward. I was not aware of his film or his book until this day. So thank you. And my comments are, I'm a Ralph Nader supporter, and Ralph Nader's talked about the wasteful military budget for at least a decade or more, and he just can't get anyone to listen to him about how wasteful the military budget is. And he just wrote a letter, open letter, to President-elect Obama, talking about Obama's failure to deal with the bloated, wasteful military budget, and talking about how the militarization of our foreign policy has got to change if we want to make any headway in the world. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Jake.
I did get to read the letter that the caller is referring to, and the letter that you said it was a letter to President-elect Obama, and just to be super fair to the facts, Nader wrote that letter before Obama was elected, because a lot of people have taken the letter and taken issue with it and said, Ralph is spoiling our joy. He can't just enjoy the moment. I don't know whether he can enjoy the moment or not, but I know that he wrote the letter when Obama was still not yet president-elect. It is a letter that deeply criticizes aspects of the way Obama has run, because Ralph is basically saying in the letter, you ran on a bunch of things and you've let a lot of them slip. You said you were against the Iraq war, but by now you're advocating a surge in Afghanistan. You're talking about an increased military budget. You've gone a little soft on some of the points you used to be really outspoken on. Nader points out in the letter that Obama has gone out of his way to play ball with the AIPAC-Israel lobby in Washington. Many people noticed that. Obama is also, like his challenger, John McCain, talking about increased military spending overall at a time where we're in a national crisis financially. These are all the sort of warning signs. Not that Obama is not a straightforward person, not that he isn't the wonderful person that I think so many perceive him to be. I actually think he is. The issue is not that. The issue is that you are already seeing Washington take its toll on this moment of change, and we've got to stop that before it starts. And Ralph Nader is doing, by writing Obama a letter, the same thing we all should be taking our own time to do, which is to be voicing how we feel, what we want, and what is our public mandate. If we don't give Obama and those other representatives we care about who represent us a mandate, I can assure you the private sector, the corporate sector, will give them a mandate.
And when you talk about how we become involved, what is it? Is it writing a letter? What is it?
It's a range of things, and I think it's super important that you ask that, and let me talk very directly to it, because everybody that I talk to, I travel a lot all over the country, and people have day jobs, and they say, you know, Eugene, I'm overworked. I don't know where you think I'm going to find the time to do something, and what am I even supposed to do? You know, am I supposed to, you know, all I remember doing, what am I supposed to, join the Boy Scouts again? Like, what do I do? And I have a very clear answer to that, and it starts in the following way. You know, the country is like a friend that you know needs therapy, and you need to push this country through a process that recognizes its shortcomings and finds greatness in fixing them. And I think Obama is asking us to do that, and he's clearly telling us he needs our help. Well, how do we help? The first thing to know is that you don't do this alone. Margaret Mead taught us that social change, changes of societies, actually, you know, she said, never doubt that a small handful of people properly organized can change the world. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has. And that's true. We need to be joining with people who we haven't joined with before, in small groupings, increasingly large groupings, that take an issue and run with it. And you run with it at a local level. It could be about health. It could be about education. It could be about water quality. It could be about economics. It could be about fairness in the workplace. Any issue that speaks to you, you learn more about it. You could read a book like mine if you were particularly interested in the war machine and why we keep being guided to war. But there's books all over the waterfront. Michael Pollan writing about food quality. Mm-hmm. And his books are, you choose your subject, the one that seems right to you, and you just become, you spend a great deal more time than you ever thought you would, not just flipping around American Idol and surfing the internet, but actually reading something and getting yourself to be far more versed in where the issue is. So many things go on in our public lives, and we don't even know what they are. We're like, oh, yeah, I heard about that prop, whatever, but I don't really know what it is. You got to know what it is. That's the first thing that this new moment in America needs of us. Just like we idealized that the 1930s, we all rose up and did something. Well, doing something today means coming to understand the complex issues we face. That's the first thing. The second thing is you join with people and you start to create pressure, and you create pressure upward on your local leadership, up to the county and state, and then ultimately the nation. And I also say that, you know, it's a little bit like dieting. People always tell you that the diets that work best are the ones that make you lose weight, but also let you kind of do the things you're used to doing.
So the whole idea is not to say to someone, you've got to throw your whole life upside down, because I recognize, I am too, that everybody is overworked and that we all run lives that don't quite even pay for what it costs to live, and we're chasing bills and mortgages and all that. But we all do have some amount of time that we spend that is not precise time, that's wasted time. We have got to harness that time and use it to make our society better. And we can do that. And if we do that, we will essentially limit the wiggle room in Washington for Washington to wiggle us out of this moment of change. And I can talk more about that. If any caller says to me, I do this for a living, I can tell you how to take what you're doing and orient it towards social change. You know, a guy stood up in an audience recently and he said, I don't know how to do what you're saying because I'm just a computer programmer. And I said, okay, do you know what net neutrality is? And I'd be asking your listenership right now, does everyone listening know what net neutrality is? Because if you don't know what net neutrality is, I would argue you don't know about the single biggest threat to even the conversation we're having right now, to any conversations about substance in an open society. It's the idea of an internet that is safe and neutral for real communicating between people, not just the communicating that the powerful want happening. And so net neutrality, which we could lose a world where we have net neutrality, is vital. And I sat in this audience, and the guy said, I'm a computer programmer. I said, do you know what net neutrality is? He said, yes. There were 500 people in the audience. I said, can I have a show of hands, how many people know what net neutrality is? And about five hands went up. And I said, this is like asking somebody in 1980, do you know what AIDS is? And no one raises their hand. This is an epidemic that's upon us that we have to stop. Nobody knows about it. So I said to the gentleman, could you inform all these people about net neutrality? So he started by explaining it to them, and I said, look, after tonight, why don't you guys all go join up with this guy and have a conversation in the hallway outside, and let's start to get some action on net neutrality for the people here tonight who are interested in it, who love the internet, who want to be part of it. So that was just one direction. A guy flipping burgers, he's got to find out what's in the meat.
Jake, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Ron next from Milwaukee. Hi, Ron. Ron's no longer there. Larry from West Bend. Hi.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Quick question. You know, it seems like money is the root of all evil, especially when it comes to politics, whether it be the local level, the state level, or the federal level. You know, what do you think the chances would be to get the candidates to limit what we spend or what they spend on campaigns, and then get term limits in place so we don't have the good old boys network? Would that make a difference, and how would we go about getting that done?
It's a huge difference. And in my book, The American Way of War, I talk about the problems of campaign finance, and that essentially the two things that a congressman most needs are the two roots of evil, as you say. One of them is that the congressperson needs to bring jobs to their district in order to make people happy. That makes them vulnerable to the wishes of those corporations that can bring those jobs or withhold those jobs. If you're not nice to me, I'll take my jobs elsewhere, that kind of thing. So first of all is bringing jobs to the district. That makes a congressperson vulnerable. That's hard to change because they just need that. The money thing is a different thing. If you were to stop the ability of corporations to give money to candidates, I mean in a real way, not in this McCain-Feingold way, which is a totally, you know, insufficient piece of legislation, but in a real way where you had the kind of public financing of elections only that they have in foreign countries and in our Western allies like Germany and Britain and France and places like that, you would stop the flow of money that creates this incredibly poisonous imbalance between the branches. And I use the defense business in my book as an example, but there's several examples, endless examples you can use for how the fact that the congressperson is so reliant on money from the corporate sector compromises the purity of that congressperson's decision-making and ultimately makes them vulnerable to the executive. And executives, as I mentioned earlier, according to Madison, favor war.
Thanks for the call. Tell me about, we've had him on some time ago when he wrote an op-ed piece. Tell me about your conversations with John Eisenhower.
He's a wonderful human being. He is the son of Dwight Eisenhower. He's an older man who has had an extraordinary life himself, both as a brigadier general and also as the author of several books of American military history. He also wrote a recent book called General Ike about his dad. And I got to meet John in my efforts to learn more about his father. And I think the last thing on earth John wanted to talk about was his father. He's done enough of that in his life. But he afforded me a lot of time anyway, as well as his daughter, Susan, who's Ike's granddaughter. And these are remarkable people, and I have a chapter in my book called Big White Men, and it's about John Eisenhower, who is a big white man. But it comes from more than that. I had an amazing conversation with John in which I had just come to interview him, and we hadn't set up the cameras yet, and I was driving with him in his car on the back roads of Maryland, getting to his to the place where we were going to interview him. And he was driving very fast, and my camera crew was in the chase car, and I kept checking to see if they were following us, because I was literally just being driven very fast by him, but I couldn't tell if his eyesight was that good.
Oh, no.
So he says to me at one point, I tune into the conversation, and he's in the middle of saying a phrase where he says, "And then we got these idiots." And I didn't know who he was talking about. I didn't know who these idiots were, so I couldn't say, I wasn't listening, Mr. Eisenhower, I'm sorry. So I pretended I had been, and as he kept talking, it became clear with these idiots, he meant the Bush administration. Now, here I'm sitting with a lifelong Republican, the son of Dwight Eisenhower, and he's just called the sitting administration these idiots. So I said, correct me if I'm wrong here, Mr. Eisenhower, but you're a Republican, aren't you? And he said, lifelong. And I tell this story in my book, and he said, and I looked confused, and he said, I voted for this guy. And that sat in for a second, and he said, well, let me explain. When I was growing up, I grew up in a Republican household, and my father was a Republican. I grew up, for heaven's sake, in the White House, basically. And he said, and I grew up knowing that Republicans were the party of big white men. I'm a big white man, so I've always voted Republican. When George Bush came along, said John, I thought, and he made clear to me that he was a representative of the party of big white men, and so I voted for him. He said, after pausing for a moment, he said, it has only been, though, during the administration of George W. Bush that I have come to learn that big white men are the men most to be feared in this world. And it was with that that he let me know that he had left that line of faith. Not that he had become some other party. John simply went back to the kind of independent thought that is so characteristic of his family. Dwight Eisenhower was a man you could hardly pigeonhole anywhere today. He would be to the left of the Democratic Party by far, because his views are far more rounded about national defense as weighed against healthcare, education, all the other aspects of what makes a nation strong. And Susan Eisenhower, who earlier this year, as you know, spoke at the DNC right before Obama, and he and was a force saying, as a lifelong Republican, I'm now an independent. Susan had a wonderful thing she said to me about this when I told her about what her father said to me. She said, you know what, Eugene, at this point, until further notice, Republican, Democrat, whatever, I'm a nothing. Until further notice, I'm a nothing. So I want to be a nothing, too. If that's what, if being a nothing is that cool, I'll take being a nothing.
Thanks, Larry, for your call. Matt from Lake Geneva, hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
There's an 800-pound gorilla in the room, and we're not talking about it at all. And I'm not amazed, but it is a sad thing. The banking system makes all of this possible. You know, we have a central bank in the United States that is basically an unregulated cabal of private bankers who can create money out of thin air. The state, the government has given them the power to create money out of thin air. So the projects of the military-industrial complex can never be reined in as long as we have this central bank, because they don't need the assent of the people to do what they do. They only need to create credit to keep funding these things. And I wish that someone of your stature, Mr. Jarecki, would use your high profile to shed some light on this undemocratic system that we have.
I think it's a very good idea. There's almost nothing I can add to what you just said that would make it any better, so I hope all the listeners heard it. What you can add to it only is current events, which is, of course, the bailout we just saw came with an enormous reinvigoration and re-centralization and increasing of that. If it was an 800-pound gorilla, it just became an 8,000-pound gorilla. I'll do everything I can. It is exactly as you describe it. And I know there's a book out called The Creature from Jekyll Island, which talks about the Federal Reserve System. A lot of people, for example, think that the Federal Reserve is a public institution. I was amazed recently to learn that it's a semi-private institution made up of many banks, many of whose names are not public information. These are astonishing facts when you start to understand that very smart, very rich, powerful people along the years have done a lot of mischief in Washington, and none of us were aware of it, and we're increasingly being able to wake up to it by reading books like mine, reading books like The Creature from Jekyll Island and others. I know there's a movie online, I think called, maybe it's called Zeitgeist, that I've heard about, which I think has to do with this whole this whole sort of abortion of our system in this sense. People got to learn these things. And, you know, if you're listening right now and you can Google, you know, banking system, centralization, the Federal Reserve, start to learn about these things. That's the starting point. What you can then do about them has to do with exerting pressure on your leadership at the local, state, and federal level for transparency about this system. Without transparency, we can't even get them to admit to what's wrong with it.
The author of The American Way of War, Guided Missiles, Misguided Men, and A Republic in Peril, Eugene Jarecki, is with us, creator of the award-winning documentary, Why We Fight, and we're welcoming phone calls for him, 800-486-8655. If you're liking to send us an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Eugene Jarecki, our guest. His book is The American Way of War, Guided Missiles, Misguided Men, and A Republic in Peril. Charlie is our next caller from the Milwaukee area. Hi, Charlie.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment. I'm an elected official in a small community, and one of the comments that your guest made is that we as Americans should be involved in the process, and being knowledgeable about issues is so very important. I think that I would agree that contacting your officials by letter or telephone call or whatever, or just knowing what they're talking about, is very important. Although I do think that on Tuesday, when we elected Obama and the Democrats basically took control of this country, we stepped the agenda and we pulled the government, in so many words, what we want done. Because Mr. Obama was telling us when he was campaigning what he was going to do. And we said, go ahead and do it, Mr. Obama. That's what we want done. And I think that's what we did, isn't it?
I think we did that, but you can have that be forgotten very quickly if we take our eye off that ball. It's like anything. If you tell your kid to clean their room and you go away, what are the odds that you're going to come back and they will have diligently cleaned their room? Well, you always have to come back, and you notice they found a toy that got interesting to them, so they started playing with that, and the room is still half done. And, in fact, then they take the toy out, they take another toy out. I've come back, and my kid has made the room messier than when it started. So vigilance on this is just like being a parent. I always talk in terms with this country of being a parent or being a friend. It's tough love. It's not that you have to be an adversary to Mr. Obama. You have to be the same guiding conscience that Mr. Obama has asked us to be. That is a very consistent kind of full-time job of civic engagement. It should happen in every moment of your day to an extent. Obviously, we all have jobs. We all have things we have to do. And Mr. Obama is quoted this morning. There was an offhanded conversation that Newsweek talked about where he said, look, it's not just about turning off your light switch. It's about something collective. He was talking about the environment. Well, that's true. This isn't just going to happen if all of us do a bunch of token things in our day that make us feel better about ourselves, and then we hope that he, Obama, can single-handedly change the world. No, this is about some behaviors we've never done before. It's going to be about joining in groups that really focus on issues, come up with solutions, pressure for solutions, and be unrelenting so that public officials, maybe yourself or others, will say, you know, hey, I'm getting directly to the vote here. I know where the vote is. I don't need to please that corporate sponsor as much as I need to keep that extremely persistent pressure group of citizens happy. They're building quite a voice here. I see them out on the corner every morning.
Thanks, Charlie. Ron from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Oh, finally got on. I don't know if the NSA cut me off twice, but I've been cut off twice in the last half hour from talking to you guys. Well, anyway, that's my question. What kind of I just love the work you're doing, Eugene. I just am so applauding of what you're doing, Kathleen, with your guests and Eugene. But what kind of opposition, what kind of censorship do you experience? From the government, from the military-industrial complex, something more than, let's say, well, they call you up and tell you you're a bad boy. But do you experience any kind of subversive controls, censorship, opposition to the work you're doing to enlighten the American people and help us make better decisions?
We have gotten to a point where our system is so internally and fundamentally corrupt that they no longer need to lift a finger to go out of their way to do me any harm. It's taken care of. For example, let's take my movies. Well, my movies are relegated to the small life of an independent documentary that shows in some theaters, and yeah, you might have heard of it, but it certainly ain't up there with Batman. And that's because our system cares has been guided by forces that have told us that people aren't interested in the truth, they just want a circus on Friday night. And so it's just like when the Romans said, just give the people bread and games. You know, so we have been treated like idiots by the system that has figured out that you actually can exploit people's desire for a break. And by the way, the more people work, the more they want a break, the less they want to have to think about all this stuff. So there is a real vulnerability there. And the system, for example, with a movie maker takes care of that because they say, well, you're only going to show in a pretty controllable little, you know, cross-section of the population, preaching to the choir. Nobody's going to really care. We, meaning we, the powerful, can count on the fact that the public is apathetic, uneducated, and disengaged. And I don't want that to be true, and I don't believe it is true, but it has been relied upon for a very long time. And if people are honest with themselves about this Obama moment, they have to be honest with themselves that they are willing to actually do a very different way of living than they have been before. When they talk about sacrifice, that's really a sacrifice of time. You have to spend time that you haven't spent before joining together with others in ways that pressure proper policies in this society. Now, when you ask me, you know, as a book author, I mean, how many people read books? I mean, I'd love more people to do it, but who's got the time? And so it's shows like this that thankfully can cut through. I mean, I listened during the break about all the viewership support that the channel has, and it said the readership, listenership support that the channel has, and it said, you know, the readers, the listeners together are 40,000 people, 40,000 people giving contributions, and that's the largest single set. Well, it sounds like Wisconsin Public Radio is already doing exactly the direction that should be happening, which is we all should be doing that. You know, that's what we care about, the radio we listen to. Excellent. Well, what about drinking water? You know, what about this? What about that? And sure, do we have money to give to all those things? No, but we do have time. We do have pieces of time we can spend to do those issues that we care about, and all of them will matter, and all of them need reform. There's no easy solution here. So censorship, I think the system sort of takes care of itself, and in a lot of cases it's self-censorship, where they've already revealed that if you go out of line, they'll swift boat you. If you go out of line, you'll be made a mockery of. It used to be cool, you know, it used to be an interesting idea to put the system on trial. Like, that's basically what the founders of this country did. But right now, if I'm writing a comedy movie, I could say, I'm going to put the system on trial, and people would laugh, because it's become absurd to think that way. I think one thing Obama's done for us is he said, maybe it's not so absurd to think that way. But it'll become a, you know, this will become a really elusive phantom, this moment of change, if we don't jump on it and seize it, we go back to bed right now.
Ron, thanks for the call. Let's go to Alan from Milwaukee. Hello, Alan.
Hi. You know, I think the author just answered my question. It had to do with how do you break this cycle of the Congress being tied into creating jobs with corporations that hold the jobs hostage over the election system. And
the louder you become, you make it irrelevant that they're in an unholy alliance with the corporate sector. The only reason they want the money from the corporate sector is to get your vote. If you come to them and say, you know, you had me at hello, here's all you have to do to get my vote. Just do this. No, 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 don't have that conversation. Just do this. And what everybody's been saying is, well, bring me the jobs. Well, that's not the only thing that we have to think about in this society. We have a society that has more at stake right now than what our job is or isn't. So is the job issue important? Yes, it is. But that should not create a relationship where you're then allowing your public official to get bribed by those bringers of jobs,
well,
by those corporations, into making decisions the way that that corporation wants it.
Obama's,
Alan, we missed what you were saying. What?
I sent an email to Obama's economic advisor at the University of Chicago, and I said, why aren't you saying you're going to create jobs from energy independence and rebuilding the infrastructure? Like, this country is so far behind in transportation. Where are our high-speed trains that are all over Europe and Asia? And it's like, there's the opportunity to create wonderful jobs that reinforce a peaceful society.
To be fair to Obama, I did hear him in a couple of the debates talk about that some of the new energy, particularly clean coal plants and things like that, and not just making those plants, but also teaching other countries to have them and building them for them, was going to be a source, and he mentioned some number of millions of jobs that he thought would go along with it. I'm not telling you that means it'll happen. I'm just saying I think he did service that issue a little bit.
Some of what you're talking about, too, requires pretty fundamental transformation of the way things are done. I'm thinking about that person flipping hamburgers, too. If you think about where the meat comes from, then it requires some serious thought about making sure we change the way the meat is,
yep.
you know, all of that, and how we eat and what we eat and
Kathleen,
our whole system of agriculture.
There's not a part of our society that we can't look at and that
right.
is in serious need of 21st century upgrade.
And that's a tall order.
And I don't find that depressing. I find that challenging and exciting. Mm-hmm. What do we all want? For it all to be a made bed? Boring. And not only boring, but it is a made bed right now, and it's totally screwed up. So, like, what are we going to do? Just sleep on the job and hope for the best? It's not going to work that way. This is something that the interesting thing is that I come across as a guy who's, like, pre-critical of Obama, but I'm actually not. Obama's the one most loudly who's saying, I need your help, words he used in his acceptance speech.
Yes, he did.
You know, Kennedy's ask not phrase, I don't like, and I know I'm probably in the minority here, because to say ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, uh-uh, do both. Your country should be doing for you, and you should be doing for your country.
Eugene, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
A great hour.
Much.
The author of The American Way of War, Guided Missiles, Misguided Men, and a Republican Peril, Eugene Jarecki. He's also the creator of the award-winning documentary, Why We Fight. And this book is published by Free Press News. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. Veronica Rickard is with you tomorrow from 9 to 11. We'll be with you Monday for all things political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.